You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
I can't hear the music, Danny. Danny, I cannot hear the music at all. Okay, are we on the air? Okay, the music was almost invisible or inaudible, which is the auditory version of invisible. Hello, and welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this lovely Thursday in Lent with Rod Bennett. Rod, I got to tell you, amazing thing happened in Seattle here today.
So really?
Seattleites this morning, hundreds of thousands of Seattleites all reported seeing some huge, brilliant, perfectly round object in the sky today.
An orb.
Yes. We're not sure what it is. Some people from out of state called it I think it's pronounced sun is what they were saying. I'm not sure. I don't have a lot to compare it with. At any rate, it appeared in the sky this morning, and it is still hundreds of thousands of people in the Western Washington area have reported seeing it. It appeared in the kind of the southeastern skies this morning, and has been slowly moving from east to west across the sky. So I think that, this could be
strange signs in the sky.
Yeah.
Signs of the end times.
It's a visitation, perhaps, of the mothership. I'm not really sure. I'm not going to go out on a limb and say that I know for sure what's happening. But at any rate, it appears to be a cosmic event, and it's happening here in Seattle. So
I guess it is.
Listen for the civil defense authorities to tell you what to do.
Further instructions.
Wait further instructions. Don't panic. And remain calm. Stay in your homes. And hopefully.
We really are looking for a celestial event here in East Tennessee later this year. I'm pleased to be able to say that the total eclipse of the sun goes right over the top of my house here in south end of the national park. So, we are right at the center of the track, just a few minutes past peak duration. So it should be pretty neat, provided the weather cooperates.
I'm actually thinking about just driving down to Oregon just to go be in the path of totality and stand there and go, and then drive back.
Well, it takes a celestial event to get you to drive to Oregon, huh?
Well, I'll do it for other reasons, but celestial events are important. Yes, that's going to happen. I think the 27th of August, something like that?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Yeah, as a matter of fact, we have a scenic highway that was opened about 15 years ago that's the highest public highway passage in the eastern United States. Right at 6,000 feet, and which is pretty high for us. And it's just a few miles from here. And the track of totality goes right across the top of that highway. So that should be a spectacular place to be. The views up there are out of this world. So
that is extremely cool, I got to say.
You can't really look at the sun during an eclipse. I mean, you'll hurt yourself, even if you... I mean, some people have said wear welder's glasses or whatever, but even that is not supposed to be actually safe. So what you do is you look at surrounding landscapes and notice the remarkable change. The last time this happened to me in 1984 was the last... total eclipse of the sun to come anywhere near my part of the country, which I watched from a high church steeple in downtown Atlanta. So that was a pretty spectacular view to watch it all russet orange in the middle of a summer's day and get pretty dim. But being able to do it up on top of this mountain skyway that I mentioned should be really neat.
Well, I burn with envy, you know.
Well, I just invite everybody to come and join us. It should be fun.
We'll come to your Smoky Mountain home. We'll sleep on the couch, and it'll be great. Well, that's pretty cool. Yeah, well I really am thinking about seeing if I can just, you know, I mean, the nice thing about being self-employed is my boss is incredibly understanding.
Indulgent, we might even say.
Yes, indulgent. You know, if I ask him for a day off, he always says yes.
And therein lies the difficulty.
Boss, can I take a nap? Sure.
Yeah, my boss is a pushover.
Yep.
Yeah, which is what my publishers are complaining about.
But
but you're welcome to come down here to the Southern Appalachians and spend the day with us. We'd love to have you.
Well, it's a bit of a drive, but you know, we'll see what we can do. So, one of the things that I'd like to do before I get to be too much of a geezer is just
maybe too late for me, I'm afraid.
Oh well, you know, I think you're younger than me, though, aren't you? I mean,
maybe a little.
Just a kid. Oh man. Yeah, but I'd like to do one of those. You know, back in when I was a kid, the ad slogan, one of the ad slogans for Chevrolet was "See the USA in your Chevrolet."
Yeah.
And it was sort of capitalizing on the then new construction of the vast interstate system. It's hard for people younger than me to really bear in mind what an epic feat that was.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing.
It was an amazing feat, and we owe it all to Dwight Eisenhower. Thank you, Dwight Eisenhower. He basically just said, you know what? It was really interesting because the way they build it, I found this out, was that when we decided to build the interstate system, the way you sold everything in Eisenhower's day was we got to do
needed
this
for national defense.
Exactly right. Got to do this because the Ruskies are going to get ahead of us. So we need an interstate system. And so they built the interstate system. And the law that was passed to build it was called the National Interstate Highway Defense Act or something like this. But it had defense in the title.
Right.
And it had really very little to do with defense, but that was how you sold things. And the idea was, you know, we have to have this infrastructure because if we don't, the Russians will beat us. And then they'll have an infrastructure because, you know, a lot of Russians were driving out to Siberia to check out,
right,
you know, the Tunguska meteor crater or whatever.
Well, you know, as a very young officer, Ike was part of an expedition in 1919 to drive across America with an army unit. And it was a difficult feat, and many people think that the roots of the idea were the fact that it took something like 38 days or something to get this army unit from one end of America to the other in 1919, and they went way over schedule and multiple breakdowns, and it was an ordeal.
Yeah.
And then this part two of the story is that when he went to Germany, he found Hitler's already beautifully functioning, perfect German engineering Autobahn system in place. And
right.
that of course, sealed the deal. He came to America and said, we've got to have one of these for us. We've got to have one of these over here.
Well, thank you, Uncle Adolf, for inspiring good thing, you know.
His name does seem to come up on this program from time to time. I don't know why exactly.
That's where the interstate system came from. Was Eisenhower said, we need, you know, a highway system so that people are not going over these dirt roads. Because, you know, once you got out of this, you know, eastern seaboard states, it was really primitive. I remember seeing movies. The only thing I think worse than trying to drive across the western United States before the interstate system was trying to do what Roy Chapman Andrews did. Roy Chapman Andrews was an archaeologist or a paleontologist who actually He went to Mongolia. Apparently, the mission initially was to look for human remains. He had some theory about human evolution. So he went to Mongolia, and you can see these old films of, you know, him bouncing around in these like Model Ts out in the middle of the Gobi Desert, where there's just road where we're going. We don't have roads. Yeah, so they went out there, and instead of finding human remains, what he famously found were dinosaur eggs. He was the first person to discover a dinosaur egg and to figure out that dinosaurs laid eggs. And some parts of the United States were like that, trying to get over the, you know, over the Rocky Mountains, for example.
Well, 1919 was pretty early. We still used railroads like most places in Europe do now. Railroads were more important than roads, even up to and through the First World War. So it was only after that that the emphasis began to shift to roads.
World War I, a lot of people forget, was the last war to witness a cavalry charge.
That's right, yeah. As a matter of fact... Well, we're sort of outdoing each other, it seems, on this program with historical trivia bits. But I used to live in a town called Chamblee, Georgia, which is where Camp Gordon used to be. And we'll have to finish this story after the break. But
We'll tell that story after the break. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. And when we come back, we'll talk about Chamblee, Georgia, and, of course, the all-important St. Udhos, right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
That is really loud.
You couldn't hear the music, and I couldn't hear anything but the music just now.
Oh, okay.
We're having technical difficulties here, folks, but we'll get through it if we all stick together.
just hold on, and we'll make it. you were telling about...
Chamblee, Georgia. I'm sure you're all in suspense to hear what I was on about there. As some of our listeners may have guessed, we don't really have a burning topic on our minds today, Mark. We're just this is somewhat stream of consciousness between a couple of Catholic history geeks. But anyway, Chamblee, Georgia, the little town that I grew up in, is the home of Camp Gordon, which was the Army recruiting or boot camp, I suppose, for the whole eastern United States for World War I. So just about all the recruits went through Camp Gordon. In fact, if you've seen the movie Sergeant York with Gary Cooper, there's a scene that takes place at Camp Gordon where they're teaching the rookies to shoot. And, of course, the backwoodsman from the Davy Crockett country already knows how to shoot. So, And that event in real life took place there. But at any rate, all of this was in the context of horses being used in World War I. I can verify that you're correct. Horses were definitely employed because right near the house, well, actually closer to the church, the little Baptist church that I grew up attending, there were stables, U.S. Army stables, for 4,000 horses.
Really?
So, Army horses, many of which didn't return from Europe. So,
that's one of the things that Tolkien resented about modern warfare. He had a lot of resentment about modern warfare, but one of the things that he resented was that it it depersonalized
right.
Warfare. You know, you deal death at a distance.
That's right, yeah. If you're going to go and fight somebody, at least have the goodness to show up.
Yep.
Put your own life in some kind of danger, too, you know. Don't just push a button somewhere. Nowadays, the line between soldier and video game warrior has gotten pretty thin indeed.
Well, especially
guys sit in an air-conditioned building in Manassas, Virginia somewhere now, and they use a joystick and blow people up on the other side of the world. So that's probably that. I guess robots are the next step beyond that, where nobody ever actually has to kill anybody.
Yeah, actually, what it'll be will be machines killing real people.
Well, that's not what I'm saying, that nobody asked to do the killing. You know, a machine did it. It wasn't me.
Yeah. I wasn't even there. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I appreciated about Tolkien, it always helped me to, because, you know, when you reach the 1970s, one of the things that unfortunately happened with a figure like Hitler is he became mythic because of how much destruction he dealt to the world. This is one of the things I've said repeatedly is that technology is a force multiplier, so it allows smaller and smaller numbers of people to do more and more unbelievable damage. So 19 jackasses can hijack a plane and inflict more damage on the United States than on U.S. soil than Hitler was able to do with his entire empire. And because of that, it's easy to blow people out of proportion, you know, and we start looking for giant conspiracies where none exist. So I'm one of those people that thinks that Lee Harvey Oswald just got up in a tall building with a gun and killed the president, and that's all that happened. And there was no giant conspiracy, but because of the enormous suffering that comes from one person using technology to inflict a lot of pain, we start wanting the cause to be as big as the effect was. And so we start looking for giant conspiracies, or we start mythicizing figures. And so Hitler becomes this colossal figure of myth. And one of the things that I appreciated about Tolkien was that Tolkien writing about Hitler, like right at the end of the war in his letters, he writes in one of his letters, he says, "I have in this war a burning private grudge against," and this is the part that I love, "against that ruddy little ignoramus, Hitler." It's like, Hitler's not a mythic figure for Tolkien at all, right?
Yeah.
He's just this fat little Austrian jackass, right?
Yeah. The degree to which he... you know, it's, I just recently read some material on the how it's only just recently come out how large a role that drugs played in the Third Reich. Apparently, almost the entire German army was going out and doing miraculous feats of blitzkrieg, marching for 3 days without sleep and stuff because they were all on methamphetamine.
Oh, okay.
And we've discovered all the records and all the, you know, orders that were made, and they were routinely sending tons of this stuff out to the soldiers to keep them wired and positive and, you know, amped up enough to do these things that at the time ordinary soldiers thought were impossible. And part of Hitler's mystique was about these impossible feats, and a good deal of it was pharmaceutical.
Drug-induced, yeah.
Well, yeah, and he himself was apparently a pretty good victim of it, too. He had a doctor who, you know, like we've seen with Elvis Presley and Michael Jackson, and a compliant doctor who will give the patient whatever he asks for, ends up being a high-class drug pusher, you know.
Yeah.
And Hitler apparently, within the last year of the war, after the attempt was made on his life in 1944, where he legitimately did have a lot of pain, He was given these really powerful speed balls of cocaine and other things that seem to have accounted for a lot of mystique that he had over his own generals. In other words, they'd come into a briefing with just the most dire news about how the war was being lost. And then, after being exposed for half an hour to his, flights of optimism and his complete lack of dispirited disillusionment, they would come out thinking, well, he's got to have some sort of secret weapon or something. He's got an ace up his sleeve, you know. They kept, all through the war, kept expecting him to come up with an atomic bomb or a jet plane, which he did eventually come up with right at the end when it was too late. Yeah. But at any rate, all of this to say that, the guy his much vaunted powers of persuasion and, ability to sway people, not even those don't seem to have been entirely his own.
Hmm. Interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah, it's just come out factually. There have been rumors, but all the records have been thoroughly explored now, and apparently it was a big, big element.
It was Norm MacDonald. He's a comic. I was watching saw some video of him. He goes, the more I learn about Hitler, the less I care for that guy.
That's right. Yeah.
So, I was going to tell you, today is March 16th, and March 16th is, according to a small but increasingly powerful and influential group of Finnish Americans, today is Saint Urho's Day. You may be asking yourself, who is Saint Urho? Well, according to Finnish Americans, Saint Urho drove the crickets from Finland. And
you're making this up, right?
Far be it for me to make something like this up. I let other people make this up. This is the Finnish Americans who are promoting St. Urho's Day. They basically just got tired of St. Patrick's Day getting all the glory. So,
but we need today to get drunk.
St. Urho, he's there for you, man.
Get drunk and blame it on a saint.
Yeah. So Mart, they either they announced or it actually really is March 16th. Truth to tell, I don't know if there is a St. Urho. I know there's a St. Patrick. I've actually been to the Hill of Tara in Ireland, where it's ground zero for Irish Catholicism. But St. Urho, not sure if he ever existed. If he didn't, he should have. But according to the legend, he drove the crickets from Finland with the awesome words of power, Henesirka, Henesirka, Menetasta Hiten, which is Finnish, that means grasshopper, grasshopper, go away. And
what did he have against the crickets?
Who knows? But I choose to believe that that story is true because it's so great. Plus, it gives us an extra Saints Day. So today is March 16th, St. Urho's Day, according to Finnish Americans. And let us all therefore rejoice. We will be back on Breadbox Media with Connecting the Dots right after this. You're listening to me, Mark Shea, and our co-host, Mr. Rod Bennett. And we'll be back right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello. Hello and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here with Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod is the author of all kinds of fun books, The Apostasy That Wasn't, and Chesterton's America, The Christus Experiment. It just goes on and on. And, of course, Four Witnesses, another terrific book. I'm going to be at the Chesterton conference this summer.
Where is it this year?
It's in Colorado Springs. So the big plan, my wife and I are going to go down. We're going to hang out with our friend Sherry Waddell. She's the woman that wrote Forming Intentional Disciples. She lives in Colorado Springs. So we just
met Sherry.
Crash on her couch. And then Dale Ahlquist can come over and, you know, chauffeur me as I deserve to be chauffeured by Dale, off to the Chesterton conference. And, I like it when Dale has to do things for me. That just makes me feel good. You know, he's coming out to Seattle, at the end of the month. So we're going to go do our customary. We always go to Ivers, which is the local seafood, place down on the waterfront. Because he lives out there in flatland, in Minnesota, where the ocean is as far away as it can possibly be.
Yeah, which is why it's so cold, like Siberia. It's like being in Siberia. The further you get from the ocean, the colder it tends to be.
Boy, howdy, that's sure true. Yeah, so he's going to come out here, and so we always go for lunch to Ivers so he can sit there on the waterfront and look out at actual salt water, which is a sight that he seldom
just to keep his hand in a little bit.
Yeah, just to keep his hand in. And so we have,
I remember coming to Seattle when they had the Chesterton Conference in Seattle a few years back, and that was a lot of fun, too.
Yes,
that was my second trip to Seattle.
That's right.
I got to hang out some with Dale Ahlquist, which was a lot of fun.
He's a fun guy. I always have a good time with that guy. He cracks me up. And
a practicing distributist.
Yes.
A lot of people like me play at distributism. Dale Ahlquist actually has put it into practice. He will not eat at a chain restaurant, for example.
Yes. One of the
mom and pop places only.
One of the funniest. I had two really funny times with that guy. One time we were in. We were all in Birmingham, Alabama, down at EWTN, because we were shooting this play, a Chesterton play called The Surprise. It was like a video play that they did, which they still run at Christmas time. And anyway, he got invited out to like the, I don't know, the satellite, the convent thing that the sisters at EWTN had out in Hansville.
Right.
So we drove.
This was before they built the big medieval cathedral there, right?
It was there. Yeah.
Oh, okay. So, all right.
But the mission was to go. He was supposed to go out and talk to the nuns, and so we got up on a Sunday morning and headed out there. And the plan was, we'd been to Mass, and so the plan was grab some breakfast on the way up there. Well, we couldn't stop at a Waffle House, of course. That would be unthinkable, for a Waffle House is a chain, and therefore evil.
Now, probably this was before the days when you've got a little device in your pocket where you can ask for restaurants.
Yes, we didn't have that kind of fancy technology. There was not yet an app for that.
Yeah.
And so we had to find a local mom and pop place. Well, the problem is this is Alabama and it's a Sunday. And so in Alabama on Sunday, they just closed the state. I mean, there's nothing open except for chain stuff. And so we drove all around. My favorite place was the mom and pop shop that was the, mom and pop's diner and auto detailing. So you could go and get your van tricked out while you were having your bacon and eggs, had it been any day but Sunday. And so we eventually wound up stopping at this. We found a diner. We found a roadside diner. It had a truck parked next to it. I mean, a big old 18-wheeler truck. And it actually was written on the side of the door. It said, Bubba. So you knew it was the real place. And so we went in there, and there was a whole bunch of us. I mean, there was, I don't know, maybe like a dozen of us. And we all got in there, and the waitress was clearly overwhelmed. There was like, she was not expecting this mob of people to show up. And so we wound up ordering our lunch, and we had plenty of time when we got in there, we thought. But we wound up ordering our lunch, and we waited for an hour before any food started to come, and it slowly started to trickle out. Dale looks at me and he goes, price, quality, service, pick any two. And so it was good food, it was cheap food, but it took eternity to get there. And so that was my first really funny experience with him. The other time was when we were shooting Man Alive, and they came out here. We finished shooting in Savannah, Georgia, out there in your part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I flew home, and then about a month later, Dale and our director, Joey Odendahl, come out. And the plan was there's supposed to be the scene where Innocent Smith walks around the world to get home again. And the nice thing about Washington State is it has a lot of different kinds of environments all really close together. So you can go from salt water to a craggy Swiss Alpine environment and, Chinatown down in Seattle and all these other places, and there's mosques and everything else. So we could sort of fake this trip around the world by just going to these different locations in Washington State, you know.
Magic of the movies.
The magic of the movies, you know. And so we get up really early, and the plan was to drive out to Leavenworth, which is way up in the mountains. And so we go through this little town called Monroe out in the foothills of the Cascade Mountains. And I was hungry. I hadn't got any breakfast because he showed up early, and then we just blasted out the door, and I never got anything to eat. So I'm like, I am hungry. I want to eat something. Well, what do you want to do? You know, we're on a tight budget. I said, just stop at, McDonald's. What? No. Look, I will pay for it. You are not feeding the corporate beast. I just want to get a cup of
and it needn't touch cheese. Your lips, Dale.
Oh, it was so funny. So we pull up to the window. Dale's driving. We pull up to the window, and I'm like reaching across Dale to hand the lady my credit card because Dale refused to pay a nickel to McDonald's. So I was paying for my own breakfast. And so she gives me the bag, and I bring it in, and I'm like waving it under his nose because I have to reach across him to get the bag. And I open the thing. Joey's in the back seat and he's cracking up, and I unwrap the bacon, egg, and cheese muffin, and I'm going, smell.
You put him in the temptation's way, Mark.
I said, Dale, can you smell the greed? It's so soulless.
Oh, goodness.
So that was great fun too.
Well, I admire his principles. He may be a crank, but it's it's a good principle.
He's a man of principle, and I respect it. And you know, and I'm a fan of Chesterton and distributism. You know, I like the idea that everybody, you know, and so does the church, by the way. Everybody should own property.
Well, that's the gist of distributism. Is that distributism is not a plan. Its name makes it sound like it's a parallel to Marxism or capitalism or some other system. It really isn't. It's a diagnosis. It says the problem is that we've got too many employees and not enough owners. Mm-hmm. We've got another famous line of Chesterton's was when I say too much capitalism, I mean too few capitalists, not too many.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that is the problem.
That's the gist of that. And yes, it's absolutely in line with Catholic teaching.
Yep. Yep. Yeah.
One of those very deeply one of the things about Catholic teaching on this and many other moral issues is that it just stands there and tells you what the truth is.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, Catholic teaching doesn't promise that you'll be able to put this into practice very well or very easily. It just tells you what the truth is. You know?
Yep, yep.
It's like an abortion. Is an abortion ever licit in the church's eyes? Never. And yet the whole system, post-sexual revolution that the United States is built on, including all sorts of ideas about egalitarianism and what it means to be free in this society and all these other things, are completely dependent on the idea of abortion. And it can't be illegal in this system. But the church just stands there and says, well, it's still a child killing.
Yep. It's still bad. It's still evil.
Yep. Yep.
You are listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett on Connecting the Dots, when we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, now is your chance. Give us a call, 1-573-4-BREAD, 4-1-573-4-BREAD-4. So I'm thinking about writing an article about a concept that I don't hear discussed very often, but I think is an interesting one. And needs to become part of our thinking. And the idea is, and this is actually a term that comes from the Catechism, so I'm not just making this up. The idea that I'm talking about is structures of sin. As Americans, we tend to think about sin primarily in terms of individuals. So, you know, I sin, you sin, that kind of thing. And that's certainly part of it. But one of the things that the church also talks about, which is a biblical reality too, by the way, is the idea of structures of sin. So as sinners, we don't just go out there and commit sins. We also build things, if you will, in our image and likeness. So an idol, for example, is an image of our sin. We project into that idol our worship of some earthly thing. And so we make that idol part of the way in which we sin. And we can build, says the church, what are called structures of sin. So in the book of Acts, you have the story of Paul goes to Ephesus and he starts preaching there, and he runs afoul of the Ephesian silversmiths. The Ephesian silversmiths had created a structure of sin, because the Ephesian economy, a good chunk of the Ephesian economy, depended on the worship of Diana. Remember that Ephesus at this time was the site of one of the seven wonders of the world. The temple of Diana, the temple of Artemis. And so that meant it was not only a literal structure, a building, that was devoted to the worship of a pagan idol, but in addition, it was the center of this huge economic structure of sin as well, because it was, as those places tended to be, a big tourist trap. You went there and you not only worshiped the goddess, but you also bought yourself a nice little silver idol of the goddess, and you brought it home and you put it in your shrine or, you know, whatever. And so the Ephesian silversmith did a massive business and had a lot invested in the worship of Diana, a lot financially invested as well as religiously invested. There was no real line between those two structures of sin. So when Paul comes in and starts talking about Jesus, he threatens that structure of sin. And as structures of sin do, it reacts. And so he winds up getting, you know, hauled out of the Hall of Tyrannus where he was preaching, and he gets hauled, you know, to the forum, basically. And this giant mob shows up and they want to stone him to death and and Paul's like, hey, this is a chance to preach. You know, because Paul's reckless about this kind of stuff. And he's just like, oh, good, an audience, you know. But the Ephesian silversmiths set up this chant. You can imagine this happening at you know, in a stadium today, right? This giant crowd of people. Here's the guy down in the field. Hey, listen to me. I want to tell you about Jesus. And then what happens? The Ephesian silversmiths are not going to have any of that. Got to shout him down. So they start chanting, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians," and they get the whole crowd doing this. You know, I picture them like doing the wave. You know. And
shouting him down.
Yeah, what you're looking at there is what the church calls a structure of sin. So there's vested interests in place. They don't want the gospel, and that structure of sin makes it really difficult for Paul to be heard. And there's real pushback. And Paul looks at this, you know, the way Paul looks at it, in fact, will write to the Ephesians, to that audience of Christians who heard him, and he will tell them that we wrestle not with flesh and blood, but with powers and principalities, with spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. So he's aware that there's a larger spiritual dynamic going on here as well.
Right.
That structures of sin can often be empowered by powers, principalities, spiritual forces of evil in heavenly places. And so the church has a rather sophisticated way of looking at all of this. It doesn't just say it's just individuals making individual choices and that's all there is to sin. It recognizes that there's a social dynamic to sin and that we are involved with one another and that we're looking at a kind of a web, and so when you tug on one part of the web, the rest of the web responds.
Right.
And if it's a structure of
these
sin,
structures are something that make it difficult for you and I to avoid sinning in certain areas.
Right.
In other words, that's one of the classic features of it, is that your whole society is structured in such a way that it's difficult not for you to not to live your life in a way that partakes of this particular right. Sin that's threaded into the warp and woof of the whole society.
Right.
Maybe an extreme, but enlightening example in our own history is slavery.
Right.
Even someone who, I mean, you'll often hear Jefferson and Washington and some of our best, most enlightened people of that era blamed for not freeing their slaves. But a classic example of a structure of sin was the society they lived in. The in many states where it existed, freeing slaves without having a definite place for them to go or job for them to do was against the law.
Oh, really? Okay.
Absolutely. And if you did turn a slave loose, there were no jobs for him. There was no any employment in that sense in a slave-based society.
Right.
He doesn't own any property. He can't eat the Declaration of Independence.
Mm-hmm.
So the system was actually designed to discourage freeing slaves, not because there was a hatred for the slave in the abstract, but the society was built on a different principle.
Mm-hmm.
And that having free former slaves running around with no visible means of support was a dangerous challenge to that system. Mm-hmm. So even people who might have wanted to free their slaves were prevented in various ways, simply on the principle of not wanting to turn them out into the big world without any place to go or anything to do to earn their right. living. So it forced people to partake of, I won't say forced literally, we always have a choice, but it exerted pressure on people to continue to support an intrinsically sinful system.
Right.
And it also put all sorts of temptations in people's way, even people who disliked and disapproved of slavery, and there were many of them. It put them in a position of having an un-Christian sway over another person's life that led them into all sorts of bad dangers to their own souls, the slaveholders. So that's an example of a system based on a structure of sin, based on an iniquitous principle, that it was, once you got in it and enmeshed into that society, it was actually difficult to find your way out of it.
Now, it's interesting that there are examples through history, and particularly from, you see this with Christianity, where Christianity, by the nature of what it was, challenged and in a number of cases overcame structures of sin. So, for example, one thinks of the games of the Colosseum. Roman society was built on, particularly when it becomes an empire, what you do to keep the population quiet is you do bread and circuses. So the idea was that, you know, Roman citizens would pour into the Colosseum and you would amuse them with gladiatorial games in which people fought to the death, because that was really fun and cool. And this went on for centuries in Rome. This is a tradition of Roman culture, was the Colosseum and the use of slaves as gladiators and so on. And what brought it down was shame and repentance from the gospel message. It simply became intolerable.
Right.
The
same thing happened with slavery in Roman days.
Right.
The whole
right,
Roman yes. society was based on a bedrock of human servitude. Slavery was the whole Roman economy was based on it. There were probably 3 out of 5. People living in the Roman Empire were slaves.
Yeah.
And but it's interesting, you can look for the declaration by which the Pope of Rome or some other authority outlawed slavery. We don't ever find it. What happened is that gradually, just like with the gladiatorial games, as people's way of thinking was changed, it became obvious slowly that that this was incompatible with it. Gradually the slave evolved into the serf, who evolved into the peasant, who eventually evolved into the free farmer.
The citizen. Yeah. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, our co-host today. I remember who I am. It's a hard thing. Our co-host today was Mr. Rod Bennett. Our producer was Danny Head, and we will be back tomorrow with Doug O'Brien. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.